It's time for Mac Geek Gab, and listener Ben brings us our quick tip of the week by telling us. He says, I learned from an outdated Wikipedia article that you can press Option Space in the Finder to instantly preview a selected item in full screen. I know, it's crazy. And he continues. He says, in the full screen, you can page through a multi-page PDF using the space bar. Additionally, you can select multiple items of one or more kinds first in the Finder and then use Option Space to present a slideshow, the same kind that works invoking normal quick look and then manually toggling it to full screen, as reported by Kent back in episode 1031. Very cool. More tips like this, plus your questions answered today on Mac Geek Gab 1037 for Monday, May 13th, Top Gun Day, 2024. Greetings, folks, and indeed, welcome to Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in and we share tips like that. You send in and we share your questions, hopefully with some answers for you. And you and we contribute cool stuff found that we share. We string it all together into an agenda that is organized such that we each have a great opportunity to learn at least five new things. Every single episode we get together, sponsors for this episode include BBEdit at barebones.com and coda.io/MGG, where you can go sign up for free to create the one doc to kind of rule them all, bring all your text and tables together. We'll talk more about both of those in a little bit. For now, here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in South Dakota, I'm Adam Christensen.
And Adam, we're missing Pete this morning because he didn't have room in the plane to fit his microphone. that's only sort of a misinterpretation of what happened. He flew his small plane somewhere and repacked his luggage for weight and in the process wound up forgetting his microphone for today. So we don't have Pete for today. We tried to find a new schedule to make it work, but there was no schedule. By the time we knew about it, it was too late to find it another time.
Too late to call an audible. I was going to say one day, maybe we'll get back to having three people on the show.
I was thinking yesterday. I was like, oh, this is going to be nice. We'll have all three of us. And someday we'll find out what the show's like without me here. But today is not that
Whoa.
Day. I know. Maybe, right? I mean, but we
let's
could.
Not get crazy.
Let's not. All right. But let's do go to Troy here, who has a quick tip for us that he recorded and sent in. So we'll let Troy share this one.
Hey, Dave, Adam, and Pete, or Dave, Pete, and Adam, or Adam, Dave, and Pete. Or if you want to go in reverse order, we could do that as well. I have a quick tip for you. I can't believe that I did not know this. If you are in a browser and you have a lot of tabs open and you want to move from one tab to the next, Control Tab will lead you to the next tab. Control Shift Tab will go back one tab. This is a lot like the application switcher, which is Command Tab. Or Command Tilde, which will take you back and forth. I do presentations, and a lot of times I want to go from one tab to the next tab, and this really helps. Obviously, you can use Command and Number to go to 1 through 8, or Command 9 will take you to the last tab in a window. But the Control Tab going to just the next tab is really powerful. I use a laptop and an external screen, and sometimes my external screen, I can see a lot more tabs than I can on the built-in laptop screen. And Control tab has saved my bacon because I can get to those tabs and move around those tabs very easily. Thanks for all you do. I really appreciate it. Have a great day. And this time, I did not get caught.
Very nice. Thank you, Troy. I didn't know about Control Tab in Safari. I guess I have some recollection of the, you know, Command 1, right? It's Command 1? No. Yeah, Command 1, 2, 3. I'd forgotten that. But I had heard that before. The Command 9, though, to get to the last tab, that I didn't know. That was new to me. I just assumed 9 would go to the 9th tab, not the end tab. I like this. This is good.
Yeah.
And the command 1 through 8 will go to your pinned tab starting, like command 1 is your first pinned tab. It's not it so just bear that in mind too. So.
And this is in Safari
for
sure.
Yes.
I just tried it in Edge and it did work in Edge. I'm wondering how many apps like this is consistent in. It's going to be consistent, I bet, in a bunch of apps until you have that one app that it doesn't work in because some developer did something different outside
of
Apple's built-in stuff.
Yeah, interesting. And I also, like, it was super distracting listening to that because there were several things that I didn't know. Obviously, I knew Command Tab would go forward in the application switcher. I also, if I want to go backwards, I used Command Shift Tab because I had no recollection or idea that Command Tilde or really Command Backtick, the key above the tab key on most keyboards, certainly Apple keyboards, would go backwards. I don't think I ever knew that. So that.
Yeah, I always just did the shift.
Yeah.
Version of that.
Yeah. But, you know, it actually is easier to just pop your finger up one, I think.
Yep.
So, yeah, man. Whew. Well, I'm at my 5. So I think it's time to bring the band in. And we got more to show. Mike brings us our next quick tip. And he says a relatively new listener, but he's been listening. He's a new listener for this show. He's been listening to you for over 15 years. And he says he has one of the original MacCast members' metal ID cards.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Number 67, he says.
Nice.
Yep. So
thanks for being a member.
Absolutely. That's crazy. So
if he shows up to MacStock with that, he gets a free drink.
Oh, is that how that works? Interesting. Huh.
I will still honor those folks, just anybody out there who has them, and we will be at MacStock this year. So
yeah. Cool. All right. Is it one free drink for like the entirety of MacStock?
Per event.
Per event. Yes. Okay. I just wanted to know. It's, you know, maybe
up to $10.
Oh, there you go. All right. There you go.
Yeah, it says on the back of the card. It has all the details.
It has all the details. Oh, it's I love this. That's awesome. I love that. All right. He says, I love using Apple Reminders app and all the cool tie-ins and functionality it offers me, especially speaking simple reminders into my Apple Watch. But one feature I have tried and been completely unhappy with is the proximity setting for reminders. Picture this. My town does street cleaning on the side of the road that I generally park on Friday mornings. So after several $60 tickets, I decided to set up a Thursday evening reminder to move the car. No biggie, right? Well, occasionally, I need to run out for an errand after the reminder goes off. And inevitably, when I return, my wandering 50-something-year-old mind doesn't remember to not park in my usual place. So I tried setting up a proximity reminder when returning home to remind me to move the car. The problem is that it goes off when I'm actually home, sometimes not until I've walked in the front door. This is not when I want to find out about this. I've often wondered if there was a way to adjust the distance from the location, and I almost wrote in and asked a question, but I figured it out. When you set up a location-based reminder, do this. Set up the reminder, give it a name, and then click the little I in the circle to see the details. Once there, turn on the location toggle and choose the location. Side tip, clicking on a location a second time will toggle between arriving and leaving that location. Oh, that's a nice little bonus quick tip. Once you do that, Click the eye that shows up next to the arriving location name command, and this is where you will see a map with a circle around the location. The circle has a dot that allows you to resize the distance, and my problem is solved, he says. So thank you for that, Mike. Amazing. I love this stuff. It's great.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. It got me wondering, because you can use, I think you have to be pretty close. You can use an AirTag as a beacon, basically.
Ooh.
And you can trigger all kinds of shortcuts and HomeKit things with an AirTag. I don't know if a lot of people know this or not, but I'm wondering if you had an AirTag in the car, if it works, you know, if you move away from it. But I think you actually kind of have to tap it. It works more with the NFC. So you actually have to tap it on something. Yeah, I had one set up where I just had it on a table in the living room and I could put my phone by it and it would, you know, turn on the TV, the Apple TV, and then set the lights and
amazing. I did not. That's all right. Now I got to play.
Yeah.
I thought I had an extra AirTag that I've been trying to like give away to one of my family members. Like, don't you need one in your thing? And they're like, nope, got one. And now maybe that's not an extra AirTag. Maybe it becomes the proximity AirTag. So
yeah.
I like it. Cool. I wonder if I could have it like auto launch my studio. Like I'm in the studio, turn on my focus mode. I put my phone down, right?
Oh. Yeah. Just tap it on the way in the door. You could.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. All right. Yeah. All right. Cool. Next up.
Yeah. I got David in Missouri. Actually, my mom lives in Missouri. So
nice. Cool.
He says, I sometimes want to change out my desktop wallpaper based on the season, and I will fall down a rabbit hole trying to find the exact type of image that I have in mind. Usually I settle for something close enough from one of those spammy wallpaper archives. A couple of weeks ago, I thought I'd try using ChatGPT's DALL-E integration to create a photorealistic landscape that fit what I wanted, rather than searching all over the web. It took a few tries, but I did get just what I wanted. And I was even able to create two images that roughly line up across both my monitors. So it's an ultra panorama. That's really cool. When my mood changes, I can swap it out. I can control the amount of detail so my desktop icons aren't lost in the clutter. It's not life-changing, but a small use of an AI that I'm really enjoying. Very cool.
Yeah. The
idea that it could create two images that are stitchable is pretty nifty.
That is nifty. And I need to play with it more, but you know, I use the ChatGPT's DALL-E integration to create most of the episode art that you see for this show and even some of the others that I do. And now they have a refinement editor in there where you can highlight a section of an image and say, change this, leave the rest, change this, which was a problem with it. Because if I told it, like, if there were moments where it would create an image and I'd say, create an image of three nerds like doing a thing, whatever. And it would create an image with four nerds. And I'd be like, cool, leave the rest alone. Just change the number of nerds, you know, and it would be like, great. And the backdrop would change. Like it would be a wholesale change. And it would maybe go to two nerds. And it was like, nope, three. Odd numbers are okay. It's going to be all right. You know? Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I like that idea. Create your own desktop wallpaper. And his point about, you know, the level of detail so that you can still see icons and they pop off of the you know, the page and all that. Like that's often what becomes the deciding factor in whether something could be desktop wallpaper for me or not. And the same is true like on the iPhone as well. Like you could use this to create iPhone wallpaper. With ChatGPT, I routinely tell it, create a wide aspect ratio image and then give it, you know, my description instructions. You can tell it to create a square image. I believe you could tell it to create a portrait image too. So think about that as well. Yeah. Yeah, send in your prompts to us. I either share them in our Discord at MattGeekab.com/Discord or into us here at feedback@MattGeekab.com, because I think, like, seeing how we each craft prompts for any of these AI engines for images or other things, I think would be helpful. In fact, I think Discord would be an even better place, but if you're not part of the Discord and you don't want to be, then feedback@MattGeekab.com. We'll share it over in your Discord for you. So I did a thing, Adam. I made a decision based on our conversation that we had in a recent episode about red receipts. And I went into my messages settings yesterday and turned on send red receipts, the global setting, just because I find it's simpler. Life is better with it. I'm okay with it's not a privacy thing. But right. When I turned it on, I paid more attention to the details of what I was enabling. And it says, when this is on, people are notified when you have read their messages. That part I knew. The next sentence was the one that stuck out to me. This enables red receipts for all conversations. So if you've gone into a conversation and like turned it on and then turned it off, it's probably going to turn it back on for you. Yeah. And I went through and spot checked a handful of conversations after I did this and found all of them had send red receipts on. Uh-oh. Are you still there, Adam? Huh. I have lost Adam. So I will see if I can get him back. I've got him back. I don't think Adam was the one who left. I think it was me. I think I lost my internet connection briefly or something. I don't know what happened, but we're back. And as Hallways says in the Discord chat for this episode, now we see what the show is like without Dave.
It was a premonition from earlier.
But back to this red receipt. Hopefully this is a one-time premonition and not a revisiting one. But I am going to get a ping window open just to make sure that I see if and when I lose my connection again. But I did find one chat that did not have it on, which I thought was weird. But I couldn't find any others. So I don't know what the rhyme or reason is, but I can say that most of my chats, all but one, had this turned on wholesale. So I don't know what the, I don't have enough memory of the specifics of that one chat. And it was with one person. It wasn't a group chat or anything, because that you don't get red receipts in group chats yet. I would love for that to come to things, but anyway.
Yeah. So I wonder, point there is, if you do go enable that global setting, you probably want to run back through and check any individual conversations you want it off on.
Correct.
If you have those.
And you can turn it off on those. Like, that's not an issue. Yeah. I guess what I could test with, I didn't think about it until you and I started talking just now, but I could go to one of my conversations, turn it off, then go turn the global setting off, then go turn the global setting back on and see if the one that I had manually turned off stays off. Because maybe that's what happened with this other chat. Maybe I had turned it on at one point and was like, nah, I don't want that person to know. And I turned it off. I don't know. So that might be the case. But yeah, you got to spot check them once you do it. The more I think about this, the more I wish Apple would make send red receipts enabled by default, only because every other chat app does. It's become the norm. Like, you know, WhatsApp, certainly it's enabled by default. Right. Facebook Messenger, it's enabled by default. You know, the ones that I think Telegram, it's enabled by default. Signal as well, I believe. So it's just people are used to it, and it really does facilitate conversation, I think. But I do get that Apple's stance on privacy probably is what informs them to leave it disabled. Whatever.
Sure.
Yeah, it's fine. All right, Andrew has another follow-up from that same episode, 1034. We were talking about Bob's complaint with contacts app freezing, and he says he had similar issues a number of years ago. And he says he worked with Apple support, and the culprit turned out to be putting too much text into the notes field of contacts. A few words in just a few contacts seems to be okay, but the contacts app seems to be buggier than most of Apple's other apps. At one time, he says, I had over 2,500 contacts and developed a habit of putting extensive text into the notes field. After working with Apple, they found that removing that or finding ways of migrating it to other fields in the contacts app made contacts way, way faster. So I messed with this. I saw this while I was on the train back and forth to New York for Pepcom earlier this week. And I went through and removed notes from a bunch of my contacts. I had a lot of notes that were left over from when I imported into Apple Contacts from Now Contacts years ago. What it would do is when you did that import, if there was, it would, you know, match up the fields and populate the things that it was supposed to populate. But if there were fields left over in Now Contacts that didn't have a home yet at that point in time in Apple Contacts, it would just put them in the notes field and say, okay, here's, you know, you're on your own.
Yeah.
Thankfully, it labeled it with this came from Now Contacts. So I searched my notes for Now Contacts, and sitting on the train, trudging along from Boston to New York, I manually went through each one, select all, delete, select all, delete. I probably could have written an Apple script in about the amount of time that it took me to manually do those. But I didn't. So, but we'll see if it's faster. It's only been like 24 hours. So, I don't know yet, but it stands to reason. It feels like an indexing problem is what it feels like with contacts. Like even before I knew about the notes field thing, just the way that it was like you edit contacts and it would just like the entire system would just munch. It was like, man, something is inefficient here. And maybe they're not indexing the notes field, or maybe they're over-indexing the notes field. Something about it. So, anyway.
More likely not indexing it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, we shall, and it forced, you know, Spotlight to update. Like, my Mac, after I edited, and it was probably 100 notes that I pulled this out of, my Mac's CPU was just pegged for probably 10 minutes with notes and suggest D and you know, the MDS and all the Spotlight stuff. Like it was very, very busy after I did this, but it was fine. Like it was okay. So anyway, that's what I got. One last quick tip, Adam, from Dan.
Sure. Yeah. Dan has a tip about Time Machine and slowing down mounting of your drives. He says, I wrote with a question about why at startup my Time Machine disk would mount slower than my other drives, and it would also slow down the mounting of my external SSD drive that contains my Dropbox folder. This would cause Dropbox to not find the folder and throw up an error. Oh. This happened with my previous Time Machine drive as well. I had just started a new Time Machine backup on a new drive, so I decided to reformat and start all over. I formatted as macOS Extended Journal this time instead of APFS, since it's a spinning drive. The problem went away.
Ooh.
Then I added encryption to the drive, and it got turned back into an APFS volume, and the issue was back. So I again reformatted to Extended Journal, but let Time Machine format the backup. Let Time Machine format the backup when it first was set up. The issue still came back. So I gave up on encryption, redid the drive as Extended Journal, and everything mounts as it should. Just thought I should share my experience. And that's Dan. He says he's another happy MacCast refugee. Ooh. So.
Go ahead. Yeah.
I was just going to say, I don't know why encryption on APFS. I mean, I run my Time Machines like that. I've never noticed an issue, but, and I'm also curious about why macOS extended journaled for a spinning drive versus APFS?
Well, I mean, APFS was built for with SSDs in mind. And I think we found some benchmarking, at least early on, showed that HFS Plus, or as we call it, extended journaled, was faster than APFS. I think it was even faster than APFS on SSDs as well, but certainly on extended journal drives. APFS brings with it a whole suite of other features, like, you know, snapshots and all that other stuff that make it worthwhile, and the speed differences weren't that much on SSDs. But yeah, I can see where this makes sense. What I would be curious is, if can you run APFS Time Machine not encrypted? Is it the encryption or the APFS that's causing the mounting to be slow?
Yeah, it sounds like it's the encryption, and I don't think you have to have encryption turned on. I recommend it for Time Machine drives just because, again, that's all the stuff on your computer.
Yep.
You know, and if someone thief were to come in and nab your drive,
yeah, they've got all your stuff.
Your data's exposed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So Kiwi Graham in the chat says Time Machine does not require encryption. Of course, it warns, but it's not necessary. And also, Kiwi Graham runs a consulting business and says, I now recommend SSDs for Time Machine for most of my clients. Speed offsets costs there. I can see that.
Yeah.
I mean, you're dealing with lots of small files. And now Time Machine will leverage some of the features of APFS, we are told. And I believe that's been confirmed by, you know, folks like, you know, Howard at Eclectic Light and things like that. So, yeah. Huh.
Yeah. I guess I've never really worried about speed with my Time Machine drives. Obviously, if it was somehow affecting my mounting, and mounting in a way that was described here, where it's like Dropbox is throwing errors, because it's interesting that it's slowing down other drives.
Right. It seems like it's system two. Yeah, it's like serializing the mounting of them. Like, oh no, we're going to mount the Time Machine drive first, and we shall wait for that to come up before we mount the other one. I didn't think that. That's news to me that that's the way that it works, at least some of the time. But,
yeah, interesting.
Yeah. All right, folks. Have you ever found yourself lost in a maze of documents, spreadsheets, and apps, feeling like you might need a GPS just to navigate through your projects? Well, I've been there too. That is, until I found our sponsor, Coda. Now, I use Coda with a few of my other ventures, and let me tell you, it's like having a command center right at my fingertips. Coda brings together everything I need into one platform, so I can say goodbye to that dizzying dance of tab switching, and so can you. With Coda, managing workflows feels like conducting an orchestra. Everything's in sync, and everyone knows their cues. Whether it's setting OKRs, sharing roadmaps, or just getting everyone on the same digital page, Coda handles it with a maestro's touch. Plus, their vast gallery of templates is like having an endless supply of productivity hacks right at my fingertips. So don't get caught in the tangle of traditional tools. Whether you're running a podcast, a startup, or just trying to organize your chaos, Coda is your all-in-one solution to streamline, collaborate, and truly unify your work. So if you want a platform that empowers your team to collaborate effectively and focus on shared goals, you can get started with Coda today for free. I know. Head over to coda.io/MGG. That's coda.io/MGG to get started for free. coda.io/MGG. Give it a whirl and watch your productivity soar. And our thanks to Coda for sponsoring this episode. All right. Have you ever wondered how we keep our podcast episodes crisp and precisely marked with those handy chapter markers? Well, the secret's out, folks. I use BB Edit, our sponsor and my go-to text editor to manage and massage those. And it's not just for coding, but for managing all those timestamps that guide you through our tech talks. BB Edit isn't just any text editor. It's like the Swiss Army knife for anyone who juggles with text. Its new mini map feature, a game changer for navigating through complex documents, like having GPS when you're deep diving into dense code forests. And for those moments when I'm wrestling with Markdown or need a quick command reference, BB Edit's expandable cheat sheets are my backstage tech crew, always ready to hand me the right tool at the right time. It's like having cheat codes for text editing, making sure I don't get caught in a coding bind. Whether it's crafting code, wrangling words, or pinpointing those podcast particulars, BB Edit boosts my productivity like a turbocharged engine in a race car. And with its robust support for everything from language server protocol to Anaconda environments, it's as essential as my microphone. So don't get caught with your script down. Let BB Edit lift your text handling to the next level. Head over to barebones.com to see how BB Edit can sharpen your text tactics too. Because in the world of podcasting and coding, precision is just a BB Edit away. Again, BB Edit at barebones.com. And our thanks to BB Edit for sponsoring this episode. So there was an Apple event last week, Adam.
Yeah, I caught that.
Did you? 37 minutes of it at 10 in the morning for me anyway, which was pleasant. Yep.
Yeah, I caught the replay, but yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, new iPads and stuff.
New iPads and stuff. So the thing that jumped out to me more than anything were the new features coming to Logic on the Mac.
That
was interesting, that the new sort of AI, you know, musician, for lack of a better term, features, you know, AI instrument playing features, which make life easy. Even as a drummer, sometimes I'll use the drummer in there just to mock something up and get an idea. And it's like, okay, now I'll go sit at my drums and like play it. But it can be really handy for the creative process to be able to do some of that. So I was excited to see updates coming to Logic like that, regardless of what they are. That's a good thing. What jumped out at you?
That I was not in the market for a new iPad, and then suddenly I am in the market for a new iPad now.
Oh,
I mean, I was somewhat in the market for a new iPad. So yeah. I have an iPad Pro 11 inch. I don't even remember the generation. I've had it like for forever.
Okay.
I'd have to actually double check it.
Yeah, yeah.
And recently, I didn't notice this for a long, long time, and I think I mentioned this on a previous episode, but down in the like lower left corner, there's like a crack in the glass, like hairline crack. It's not really noticeable unless I'm looking right at it, but it's enough to kind of bother me a little bit.
Sure.
And so I've been thinking about getting a new iPad for a while, and yeah, and when I saw those new iPad Pros and how thin they are,
yeah,
and right, light and sexy, it's just like, oh, maybe it is time for a new iPad Pro.
There you go.
But then I thought, I just can't really pull the trigger on the cost, because like I just don't. I mean, I use my iPad a lot. I used it a lot more when I was, you know, doing the MacCast.
Got it.
Full time, or
yep.
Yeah, pretty much full time.
Yeah, know, right.
Job.
Yeah.
But now, like when I sit down, yeah, I don't have a need as much anymore. I'm more at my computer.
Yep.
So I still enjoy my iPad, you know, and I have an iPad Pencil, and I don't use that quite a lot. So like when I really try to justify it, it's like, no, I just want it because it's really, really cool.
Because it's cool.
I've got a crack in mine, and mine is like 4 generations old. So, yep. You know, I could justify buying one, but I probably don't need to spend that money.
Yeah, I don't use an iPad enough to keep it up to date either. And I like the iPad mini form factor. Well, I say I don't use an iPad enough to keep it up to date. I use an iPad all the time behind my drums. It is, if I'm going to have notes or, you know, sheet music or anything, like I'm doing a run of a musical called Spring Awakening right now, and I am reading the music on my iPad mini, and it's great. Sometimes I'll use a larger iPad. I also use an iPad to control my audio mixer, like the one that we'll use live when we use bands or to mix my in-ears or whatever. But the iPad minis are great for that. And even older generation iPad minis. I mean, I keep a stack of iPad minis here just to be able to run those apps, and they don't need to really do anything else. They're sort of purpose built at this point for me. And then I have the current generation iPad mini, whatever that is. I did upgrade to that. And that's sort of the thing that I'll watch movies on like the train or the plane. And it's the thing that I use in bed when I probably should be reading on my Kindle is also what the iPad mini does for me. But I don't need the latest and greatest there. It's not a productivity tool where speed matters. You know, page flipping when I'm right. on stage is kind of the thing.
Yeah, and that's the other thing is, like, I don't do anything real performance oriented. So, like, as cool as, you know, it is that they have an M4 now and all that fun stuff, I don't know that I can really justify that. Brian in the Discord points out something that I had heard, which is, I think, I don't know if ironic's the right word, but just interesting, is that the iPad Pros are now thinner and lighter than the Airs, the new Airs. So I don't know why. Can you still call it an Air?
Huh.
If the Pro is thinner and lighter?
Yeah, that's a good question. Let me pull up a chart on Apple.com. And I believe that could be true. Let's see what. Right, let's get to the.
I've heard it from a couple sources. So
yeah. Yeah. The iPad Pro is 5.1 millimeters thick. Thin, as Apple said in the thing. They did not use the word thick. They said it's 5.1 millimeters thin. And the iPad Air, these are the 13 inches, is 6.1 millimeters thin.
Yeah, 1.28 pounds versus for the Wi-Fi versus 1.36 pounds.
Yep. And the same with the iPad Pro 11 inch is 5.3 millimeters versus 6.1 on the 11 inch Air. And 0.98 pounds versus 1.02 pounds. So the difference of 18 grams, folks. Huh.
Yeah. And they did add a 13-inch Air, which I guess is good for people who like that form factor. I mean, honestly, if I was going to buy one, I probably should just buy an Air, because
yeah.
much less expensive and would be a huge upgrade from what I have.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, it's still got an M2 in it. Like, yep.
Yeah, but the Pros just look really
so speaking of expensive toys from Apple, Adam, I want to check in. How goes it with the Vision Pro these days?
I still love that thing. I absolutely love it.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's been relegated just because of like use cases. It's really been relegated to an entertainment device. I mostly just watch movies on it and occasionally play some games. I'm not using it as I thought I might for very many productivity things.
Yep.
And that was another interesting thing about the Apple event, is because Tim opened up, as he does, talking about, you know, things outside of what they're going to talk about at the event. And obviously, right. Vision Pro is like a big one of those, right? He showed a bunch of use cases. And I think what we're seeing, at least with this version of the Vision Pro, is these very specific market verticals. So it was like science and research and like doctors. I think he showed a Stanford doctor or somebody using it for eye stuff and visions, and people using it for training, you know, onboarding people and training and, you know, showing how to do things. And I think it's doing really well in that space. And I think that's where you're seeing app developers maybe gravitate. It was very interesting because if you remember the original announcement, they kind of showed all those business use cases, right?
Yeah.
You're going to use it for Zoom and you're going to use it as your virtual displays. And I think people aren't using it like that. And so they didn't really show any consumer level uses of it. It was like very, very business vertical focused.
Yep.
And I think that's where it is kind of right now. I'm just waiting for that sort of killer app to come out that gives me the real use case to have that on my head for a long period of time. I do still need to probably more firmly dive into the using it as a display, and see if I can actually make that Go for work. I played around with it a little bit, but I haven't really given that a really good shot. And that's only partially because my desk setup isn't set up for that. Really? Like, I need a clear space in front of me to put my laptop. I use two screens and I use it in clamshell mode, and I'd have to like rejigger my whole desk environment. So I've just been avoiding that.
I can see that. No, the rejiggering of the work environment is not something to be taken lightly. Like, I've always kind of dreamed of the day, and I don't even know what, to me, the word, you know, retirement means, but of when it's like, oh, I could completely re-envision my work environment and spend several days sort of getting into a new flow. When I moved the podcast scenario around, when we started it, this room wasn't finished being built. So I was downstairs, but then I moved up, but I was 180 degrees opposite of where I am in this little alcove in my studio. And even turning that around was like, oh man, like this sucks. So,
yeah. Cause the use case for the Vision Pro, using it in that way, I mean, essentially you wouldn't have displays. You just have your laptop, right? And then the virtual displays become your displays. So, you know, and I just don't have that kind of an environment. And and the idea of rejiggering that, all that stuff, to try something and then potentially finding out that's not a good workflow, then I got to put everything back.
That's, yeah.
I need a test environment.
Right. Yes. That also, it like doesn't mess up your work environment, but also doesn't take time away. Like you need magic. You need magic realm to be able to go to. Yeah.
I thought about just trying to, you know, like set up at like my kitchen table or something for a day and see how that goes. That's probably the right way to do it.
Yeah. Find a day when your family like isn't around in the house or whatever and just be there. Cause I would almost certainly have gotten one if I was traveling more than I currently am, because I can totally see where, like, on the train back and forth to New York, it would have been awesome to have it to, you know, have my workspace right there without needing to like spread things around, and certainly in hotel rooms and all of that. So, yeah.
I mean, the other hope really, I think, is that, again, I think people are still trying to figure out what to do with this. And the reality is like, I think just like the Mac Pros, the Vision Pro is going to be its thing in its current form factor for many, many years. So there's like years for things to develop. Yep. I think there'll be a consumer version, obviously. It's going to trickle down more quickly than that. But I think, you know, you're going to have the Vision, or whatever Apple ends up calling it, be the device that's kind of iterated. And then the Pro kind of every few years gets iterated, just like they did with the Mac Pro, would be my guess.
That sounds right. I had an interesting conversation with a friend who recently was diagnosed as having ADHD. They probably had it for longer, but it's certainly become something that's impacting their life. I've actually never been diagnosed with it, although I don't think I need to be. I've been aware of my distractibility for a very long time, and I've learned to live with it. And I've, in some ways, have learned to kind of make it a superpower, right? Like I've organized my life around it, and I'm okay with it. And I'm fortunate that I was able to do that and unmedicated and all those things. But this person is sort of learning about it and how it's impacted and impacting their life. And one of the things that they noticed is, it's like, oh, I never watch a movie without my phone in my hand or doing something. And I wind up missing huge stretches of like the dialogue in a movie or the concepts in a movie because I get distracted. And they have a Vision Pro, and they told me, I watched a movie in my Vision Pro and it was amazing. I had no opportunity to be distracted. I watched the entire movie. I didn't have my phone in my hand. I was in the immersive environment. They could have had many windows open in the Vision Pro, right? But they went into like whatever it's called, you know, immersive theater mode, and just watched it like you might in a movie theater. And they're like, this is kind of amazing for me to help me focus. And then started talking about, well, I could also use it for when I'm doing work in a certain way, and just going into that world it kind of forces the to leveraging the sort of hyper focus aspect of ADHD that exists. And I thought that was a really interesting thing. Now, that's a really expensive way to do it. You could probably get away with some version of that with, like, you know, the Meta Quest at $500.
Right.
But you know, I it was interesting hearing them, like, singing the praises of this. It's like, wow, that's fascinating. It just never dawned on me that, but that's part of how that works. Yeah.
Yeah, you'd still need to turn it, put it into like a do not disturb mode or whatever, because right. you get notifications, and it's actually really distracting when you're watching a film, because the way the notification comes in is you get the icon at the top of the screen where the control center would be.
Yep.
You get the icon for whatever app that notification came in for. And then it, obviously if you look at it, then you can interact with it. Right. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, they had it in do not disturb mode. Yeah.
It hovers there for a while.
Got
so.
It. Got it. Yeah.
I wish it would go away sooner.
Yeah,
and especially
sure.
like if you were in full environment mode, you would hope. I might need to play with this. Maybe it does if you're in full immersive, you know, 360 environment mode. I don't know if you see those or not, and I'll have to test that. But I think they still come in.
Got it. Yeah, makes sense. All right. Well, thank you for the check-in. I just you know, curious about this. So yeah, folks, send in your check-ins. feedback@mattkeekup.com. I think this is another one of those things where the more we learn about how each other is using it, we'll stumble on to those killer apps. I don't think there's going to be one killer app for this that is universal. I think it's going to be a series of them that sort of touch our lives in a way that means something individually. So,
yeah, I definitely want to hear from people who are doing that.
Yeah, for sure. Gil has a question. Separate from all of this, moving into our next realm. He says, hello, good to see and hear. Adam is well integrated into the show. Indeed. Mother's Day in Mexico is, well, coming soon from when he emailed. It was May 10th is always the day. So I want to surprise my wife with a new M3 Air and retire her 2019 Intel. Since I'm a loving husband and the geek of the family, I'll do the setup for the new one. I see two options regarding the backup. But if I'm mistaken, please let me know. One, use her Time Machine backup and go from there. I have Time Machine set up on our Synology since 2020, so there's a lot of data there. And then that would be one option. Option two, start fresh without the Time Machine backup and re-download all the apps. But here is my concern. What will then happen to the old backups? Would I lose them? And which path would you recommend separate from all of this? Hope you can shine some light on the pros and cons. He says, we do have an Apple One subscription as a family where we share the storage and all of that. So not sure if that factors in. So thoughts on this, Adam?
Yep. I mean, I think it's always easiest to do the migration either from Mac to Mac or from Time Machine or from some other clone backup or whatever. That's my preferred methodology. The only time I ever recommend sort of setting up fresh is if you know the machine that you're migrating from is having weird issues that you just can't solve. Like if it's just something is wrong with this machine and that's why I'm upgrading, that might be a good moment or time to think about doing that. In terms of what I would do with the Time Machine if I was doing that is I would not connect the Time Machine back up until you've kind of completely, if you did do a fresh system, completely rebuild the thing and then reconnect Time Machine. I think the way Time Machine works, if I'm remembering right, is I think it kind of sets up a new system, but you still have a previous backup, is that right? Or I forget what they call it, but
no, that would be right. Like it wouldn't know that it should even think to replace it, right? I mean, these are two different Macs at this point, and so
right.
Time Machine would just set up something new. You would be left with a lot of storage consumed from that
right.
old Time Machine backup. My favorite thing to do in those scenarios is to shoot a disk image of the Mac that I am retiring and save that to my Synology or whatever and basically put it in cold storage and just leave it there in perpetuity And that way, that just gives me the freedom to reformat that old Mac right away, as opposed to saying, well, I probably should leave it around for a little bit in case I forgot to get some data off it. It's like, nope, I've got a disk image of that data. I'm good to go. Wipe and go. Do whatever you need to do. So, but otherwise, I agree. I mean, obviously, there is some benefit in the nuke and pave method, you know, option number two for Gil. But that's a lot of work that, unless you're having issues, nuke and pave becomes more of a troubleshooting step. It can be a proactive step against needing to troubleshoot in the future, but because it removes all that cruft by sort of its very nature. But I don't know. I get lazy with it, and migration assistant works so well that that's what I do. So
yeah, you're just gonna spend a lot of time for probably no reason. Like Apple handles all that stuff really, really well. And I like what Kiwi Graham put in the Discord too. Like Mac to Mac is the way to go if you can do it. You know, just Thunderbolt cable between the two machines, and it'll be much quicker than from probably Time Machine Backup. You know, if you're like me, your Time Machine Backups are old USB spinning drives or something like that. So
That's fair. Because if you can avoid having to migrate from a Time Machine Backup, you're going to be better off in many cases. And then you could inherit the old backup, if you migrate, then you're good to go. I like that.
It'll say, I forget what it says, it's something like, do you want to inherit, is that the word they use or whatever? Old backup. I often don't worry about Time Machine Backups. I'm like you too. A lot of times what I'll do is I will take my current Time Machine drive and just use at the same time I got the new Mac, get a new Time Machine, set up a brand new one, and just archive the old one, because you can always pull that back and use Time Machine to read that drive if you need to get files off of it. I very rarely find that I need to do that though, because if everything has migrated over and you're running a system, you're not going to have the history. I have very rarely, and I ask people about this a lot, because people worry with their Time Machine Backups about losing that history. And I often ask people, how many times have you used that feature? Like, I haven't used that feature to go back and grab a file in maybe a decade. Like, it's happened occasionally. There's been one or two times, but very rarely. It's more often the scenario where something's gone wrong and I need the whole backup.
I need
Time Machine backup, not just that, I accidentally deleted a file, 2 weeks ago, and I need that file back. Or
I have to answer your question that you didn't ask me. I have done that once, and it saved my bacon. I've shared it on this show. Somehow I deleted the entirety of my presentations folder, which had every keynote from every, Macworld Expo, whatever it is, CES, MacStock, user group, all of those things was just gone. And I have obviously no recollection of choosing to delete it. But, I did. And Time Machine was, I believe, the best place. It may not have been the only place that it existed, but it was the most recent place that it existed. So it's like, okay.
Yeah. I mean, if you have Backblaze or something like that, it's probably in there.
It would have been there.
I've talked about this on the show in the past too. I have my ChronoSync that I have set up to not sync deletions. So that's like my
net. Yep. That you gotta have a safety net. I like to have a safety net for sure. Yep. All right. Should we move on to Jeremiah?
Yeah. So Jeremiah has some issues with the time on his Mac. He says, every time I log on to my MacBook Pro 2019, the time is wrong. Set time and date automatically is turned on. I've tried turning this off, but the next time I log in, the time is still incorrect. The only way to fix it is to toggle that setting off and then on again, and it resets to the correct time. But again, I have to do this every time I use my computer. Any advice?
You cut out a little bit there, Adam. Well, you paused. I think there was some Wi-Fi issue, perhaps. But we got the question, so thank you.
Okay.
Yeah. The time is set using NTP, Network Time Protocol. It theoretically, it should do this when the Mac starts up, but clearly it doesn't. My guess is that if you left it on for 24 hours, it would correct itself because it does check in periodically with that NTP server. It's odd that it's not doing that. So you by turning it off and on again, you are forcing it to do that NTP check-in, you know, in the now. You could write a script or set up a cron job or something, or a launchd thing, because we're supposed to use launchd now, not cron, that ran the SNMTP, the SNTP app. And I'll put a command in the show notes that sort of walks through doing that. You have to run that command as sudo, which means you have to run it as root, because it is impacting the, you know, administrative portion of your system, the time. And then you can tell it which time server to sync with. And, you know, I generally use time.apple.com. So that would be the that would be a thing to do. Setting up a script that runs automatically as root is doable and is also a little bit of a trick. I would take a look at Lingon, L-I-N-G-O-N, to be your special friend there. That is an amazing app that not only lets you do things like this and configure things like this, but it's also a great troubleshooting tool because it lets you see all of the, I'll say, startup items and automated items that don't appear anywhere else. So I'll put links to both of those, or I'll put a link to that in the show notes, and then also the SNTP command. Man, it's hard not to put the M in there.
You want to say SMTP. Yeah. I want SNTP.
Or I want to say SNMP, which is Simple Network Monitoring Protocol, which has nothing to do with what we're talking about. Yeah.
If it was back in the day, I would, and he was on a desktop, I'd be like, oh, you need to check your Pram battery.
Yeah, that's the part, right? It makes me think that his battery is problematic. And it
maybe, might check battery. Oh, actually, it might be something to check, battery health.
Yeah, but it's a laptop. It's a 2019. Yeah, so it should be. That's weird. It makes me wonder if something is setting the time incorrectly on startup or on login, which Lingon would be a good tool to use to troubleshoot that too, because you can see where LaunchD is running all of those things. So, yeah, that's a weird one. Yeah, I can't figure out why that would be happening. Huh. All right, well, maybe there's a geek challenge part of this. Feedback at MacGeekUp.com, folks. We love to hear your thoughts on why this is happening. So, all right. Any more on that, or should we move to Jed?
We can move to Jed.
Great.
Jed says, oh, he wants to say a bad word, but he says, since it's a clean show, I'm going to avoid wordplay. But
Google wants us to say a bad word is what he wants.
And DKIM definitely punched me in the gut. I use Cloudflare email forwarding, and I love it. I have a catch-all email that goes to my Gmail, works great, and the price is great. So starting today, the emails I send from that address are getting bounced. Now, if I had a Google Workspace account, I could do all sorts of DKIM stuff that I don't fully understand. But since I don't, any ideas except give up. Thanks. Trying hard not to curse. Jed.
Yeah, DKIM is a four-letter word. For sure. Maybe that's the episode title. So DKIM is a convention, a standard that allows you to control things about your domain in terms of email. Things like, should this server be allowed to send email as me? Should, you know, where should email go? It works in tandem with some other things to help keep email from being spoofed is really what DKIM does. Now, the problem is, if you don't understand exactly how DKIM works, you can paint yourself into a corner where no one can send you email or no one will get email that you send. I guess it's more the latter, but you could probably get yourself to do the former as well. I certainly have painted myself into that corner. I'm almost hesitant to share this, but I will share it. There are DKIM generators. What you do is you go and you create a text record that you add to your custom domain in the DNS setting. So like where you would set where your website is or where your mail servers are, you would go and add a text record to that DNS entry that then anyone can read, and specifically any mail server will read, to see what your DKIM settings are. And I should figure out what DKIM stands for so that maybe we can talk about this. Domain keys identified mail. Sure. Yep. So, but you go and you configure this and you put a one liner in there that has all kinds of little switches and code and all sorts of stuff that instructs mail servers what to do and when they receive mail from what appears to be you, and whether to treat it as good or bad based on whatever criteria you set. But if you don't know what you're doing, and I can't stress this enough, you will almost certainly screw it up and you will be in a world of hurt like Jed is. It sounds like you already have a DKIM record set up for your custom domain, Jed. So I would use a DKIM record generator. D. Markley has one. I will put a link to it in the show notes. But just that is not enough. Once you generate that, it'll ask you some questions, right? It'll be like, where do you want to allow mail from? What do you want to do and all that stuff. And then it'll create this line of text and it'll say, great, go put this in your DNS and you're good to go. You are not good to go until you understand every character of and the implications of every character in that line, because this is your email we're talking about here. And you don't want people to stop receiving email from you. For my, I have set up DKIM on some of the domains I have, but for like my business domain, like the Backbeat Media stuff and the Mac Geek Gab stuff, I don't, because I don't understand it well enough to trust that I'm going to get it exactly right and that no one's going to bounce mail. And what doesn't help is that every mail server is sort of evolving on this front and doing things differently. Some mail servers don't pay attention to DKIM at all. So you could screw it up and send yourself a test message and be like, oh, great, it worked. I'm good to go. And you definitely want to send yourself test messages after you make these kinds of changes. But just because they succeed doesn't mean you've succeeded. So it's a whole thing. And it's something, plan to spend several hours thinking about this and being very, very meticulous. A lot of tech out there that we deal with, it's kind of cool to have a little bit of knowledge, know enough to be dangerous and start using it and then deal with the problems when they come up. Email, especially sending email, is even receiving email, it's insidious. You don't get to know when your email hasn't made it through necessarily.
So, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think overall, unless you're sending a lot of bulk email, like we use these at my job or like our clients, because I do e-commerce work, right? So the clients need to send like transactional emails and bulk emails and things that are really important to get through. But like you said, configuring and setting up these technologies, and there's actually three of them. So like DKIM is just one. There's also something called SPF, that's Sender Policy Framework.
Yep.
And then DMARC, domain-based message authentication reporting, and conformance. Ooh, that's fun. Yeah, and I overall, most people should not have to mess with these. I did post. There's a really good article over on Cloudflare that I put in the show notes that runs through exactly what all these things are and what they do if you want to learn more about them. But I think in general, most people should not have to mess with these things.
No, but a lot of us are running our own custom domains specifically for email these days, right? And iCloud makes that really easy to do. But I would say don't be tempted by the existence of these things. Use them if you find that you need to, but don't just use them because they are there. And that advice will evolve over probably the next, months or years, because at some point you will want to use these because they are there. But like, I use SPF records on a lot of things, but it's because I can read an SPF record and basically tell you what it's doing. And that's why I'm comfortable using them. But right. The DKIM and DMARC stuff, I've tried to dig in. And it's like, it makes my brain hurt. I don't understand this well enough yet. And I don't want to do it knowing enough to be dangerous. So, yeah. Cool. All right. Where are we on time here? I think we should jump to some cool stuff found, Adam.
Yeah, we should get to some cool stuff found.
Great. All right. You want to take us to our first one from Dom?
Yeah, Dom says, hey, screen time is a great idea for managing your kids and your own devices, but it has so many limitations and holes, it becomes nearly useless. One area we wanted to help our kids with is managing the temptation to play Minecraft for hours on their Macs instead of doing their schoolwork. Minecraft on the Mac is a particular problem because the launcher is a regular Mac app, but the program itself is a Java executable. So screen time can block the launcher during certain hours, but not the program itself. And since screen time gives you the option of just one more minute, and it doesn't take that long to launch Minecraft from the launcher, it was useless. I'd been pulling my hair out trying to find solutions until I remembered that there are productivity distraction-free apps out there. One I settled on is called OneFocus, and it's in the Mac App Store. You can set it to block certain apps and certain websites of your choice during particular hours. On the Pro version, $2 a month or $10 a year, you can set up repeating schedules, example, Monday to Friday between these hours. It has varying levels of hardness, i.e. how much you can lock it down, but the higher levels make it progressively harder to work with. So I've blocked the Minecraft launcher, which launches, but remains hidden in the background. So far, so good.
Huh. That's a great idea. Yeah. Huh. I never thought of using the, focus apps, the productivity apps, the ADHD management apps as parental control type apps. But obviously, it's a tool. It can be used in many different ways.
Huh. Yeah, it's interesting. I wouldn't have thought of that application either, but
smart.
Yeah, I don't know. I like Minecraft, but I get not letting your kids play a Minecraft during.
Yeah,
they should be doing homework.
Everything needs to be kind of managed, right? Yeah, for sure. All right, let's see. The next one comes from James, who started asking a question and then solved it by finding the answer.
Love those.
Yeah, he says, I am one of the many users, myself included, that suffers from the occasional issue of iMac-2.local, iMac-3.local. Right, yep. He says, I started looking for a command line string that maybe I could put into an automator action or other way of automating that just renames my Mac on startup or every 24 hours back to what I want it to be without the numbers after it. And he found one, right? He found an article actually at the University of Illinois that describes how to use the scutil command to do exactly this. And you can set your host name, your local host name, your computer name, which is probably what we're talking about. And then, of course, you use DS cache util at the end to flush the DNS cache and you're good to go. So all these commands are there. They are sudo commands. So like we talked about earlier with the uh, S NTP command. You would need to run these as root, so automating it gets a little bit tricky. Maybe Lingon is your friend here too, but I like this idea of kind of coming up with this set of commands to do and then put it somewhere and automate it so that you can reset your Mac to not have the numbers after its name. This is good. Nice find, James. And this happens when your Mac goes to sleep. Another Mac will take over kind of answering requests for it and advertising it on the network. Or another device. It doesn't have to just be a Mac. I think your Apple TV can do this too. And that's all fine. And it's supposed to hand off and hand back on when your Mac goes to sleep and wakes back up and all that stuff. But sometimes your Mac will wake back up and won't do the hand back properly. And it will see another Mac on the network with its name advertising its name, because there was another device on the network advertising its name. And so it says, oh, well, I'm now MacBook 2. It's like, nope, you were always MacBook. Stay that way. Don't change. So
I just had to spend too much time trying to figure out where this setting got moved to in the new stupid system settings. So it's under general sharing, local host name, and then there's an edit button. So if anybody else is looking for that, I'm like, where did that thing go? I knew it was always in the sharing section, but I didn't know where sharing landed.
It is in local host name. Nice find. Yep. God, yeah, they bury things. Okay, we can search in system settings. So is that how you found it?
No, I just poked around. I didn't even know what I should have just typed sharing, because I knew it was in the sharing area, but I didn't know what the thing itself was called. I couldn't remember. It was called local host name.
Yep. Kiwi Graham asked, does sudo actually execute as root or just with elevated privileges of admin users? I am pretty sure that when you run sudo on a Linux box or a Unix-ish box, that it runs that command as the root user. I could be incorrect about this, but memory tells me that I'm not, because I think this is on my Mac too, but certainly if I'm on, you know, logged into a Linux machine as me, a user not named root, and I type sudo, I guess I could do this on my Mac. We'll do this in real time. So,
well, I pulled up the man page in Dash real quick.
Okay.
Sudo allows a permitted user to execute a command as the super user or another user as specified by the security policy.
Yep. All right. Well, I just did I did sudo and then space and then touch, which touches a file. It will create it if it doesn't exist. It will update its last modified time if it does exist. I said I did sudo space touch space test for Kiwi Graham, and that file did not exist before, and on my Mac it is owned by root. So the answer to the question is sudo does execute as the root user. So question answer.
Hmm.
Yeah. As root, and the answer is yes. So now it's in the show notes too. I was at Pepcom last night and I met with the narwhal people. They are not narwhal people. They are people that work for a company named Narwhal.
I want to see the narwhal people. They got, like,
I know.
Big horns coming out of their heads.
It doesn't look like the thing from Elf or anything. No. They are actually very nice, kind people that look just like people, as you might guess, or maybe you wouldn't guess based on my description. Narwhal makes robot vacuums, among other things, and you know how much I love robot vacuums. I've been testing one of their newest ones recently, the Narwhal Frio X Plus, which is a $400 vacuum and mop, which is kind of cool, because getting a vacuum and mop for $400 is usually kind of a trick. Now, this is the, you know, for $400, it is definitely the budget more friendly model. It is self-contained, meaning it doesn't empty itself. The water tank is all internal to this, which means you have to manage the water tank more frequently, but it will do mopping and vacuuming in the same pass. And I've been using it on a floor of my house now for a couple of weeks, and it works better than any other $400 vacuum that I've ever used, let alone one that also has mopping capabilities. And the mopping capabilities are pretty good. I've found that with robot vacuums, the best thing for vacuuming is to have it do it every day so that it is not having to do any monster task. It is just maintaining the state of your home. And it's awesome once you have this because your house is vacuumed every day. Like, I wouldn't vacuum my house every day, but the robot's happy to. So and it works really well. One thing all of the narwhals have is this amazing brush. They call it their certified zero tangling floating brush. And after using this thing for several weeks, I can attest to the fact that it does not collect hair. It the way the brush is shaped, it moves hair along it and then up into the dustbin. It's truly amazing. I went and looked at it again this morning, and it's like, how come there's no hair rolled around the brush? Which not only is nice just from a maintenance standpoint, but it makes the vacuum work better when the brush isn't just covered in, you know, hair that's been rolled around it. So, and the $399 one, this Frio X Plus, has that. It's got 7,800 PA. What is that? I don't know. Whatever it is. Monster suction on this thing. And it does very well, and it will mop things up. You do have to manage the dirty water. It is sealed inside of the vacuum, which means you don't smell the dirty water until you go and empty it, which is key. And of course, it's got all the smart mapping and all that good stuff. So that's the Frio X Plus. And then they have the Frio X Ultra, which the list price is a full $1,000 more than that at $1,399. You can get it on Amazon. I'll put a link in that drops $300 off it. So it's $1,100. And this is absolutely an $1,100 vacuum for sure. It has all of the features I just mentioned for the Plus, and it has its base station with water tanks in it so that you can, it will refresh the water, keeps the dirty water in one tank, refreshes with clean water, which makes, especially for larger mopping operations, makes life way easier. And what's really cool is it will periodically go back during the mopping operation. It will go back to the base to exchange the water, right? Because and keeps the mops clean and all of that stuff. Well, what's really cool is that as it is refreshing the water, it does like a pattern matching on the dirty water that it is bringing into the back into the base. And if it notices that the water is exceptionally dirty, it also knows where the vacuum just was on your floor. And so it will go back to that spot and rinse it again, come back, check the water. Is it cleaner? Nope. Got to go back again. And it will keep doing that same spot over and over again, just like you or I would do, Adam, if we were mopping on our own. We would do the spot over and over until it's clean, and then it moves on. But it doesn't have to redo your whole floor because it's smart enough to know, oh, it was just in that one section. And so, which I thought was really, really smart. Right? Like, that's cool. So so that's the Frios from Narwhal. I love seeing the evolution of the tech with these, the especially the evolution of the brush. I can't stress how big of a deal that is. That's as big of a deal to me as the LiDAR sensors were when those were first introduced to robot vacuums, and the smart mapping and all of that. Like, the mapping on this is great. They're great vacuums. And for a $400 vacuum, that Narwhal FreeOX Plus, that's worth a look. Even just as a vacuum, even if you don't need the mopping. And the mopping's good, but it's, you know, it's not as good as it is in the Ultra for obvious reasons. So,
have you pulled the trigger on a robot mower yet?
Man, I am so... it's the robot snowblower that really is tempting to me. But if I got that, it would also be a robot mower. So I'm like really close, because the idea, you know, like I said, with the vacuum, doing the vacuuming every day, you're just in maintenance mode. Well, the same is true with the robot snowblower and the robot mower of your yard. It's not like it only does it after the storm with the snow or once a week on your lawn. It's doing it every day. So you have this constantly manicured lawn, or with the snowblowing, it's just like, it's just removing a few inches at a time and then goes back and it charges and comes back an hour later and gets the next couple of inches. So, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know, man. There seems like such a higher liability with something that has that kind of, those kind of blades, like roaming around outside your front yard, and like people walking by with their pets and stuff like that.
Yeah.
If it goes rogue, if the apocalypse happens,
that's scary. The robocalypse.
Yeah.
Beware the robocalypse. Yeah. 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 That would be bad. That would be bad. That would be bad.
Or like a child comes by, like I just, you know, the thought of an unattended device in your, especially like your front yard, I guess if you had it contained in your backyard, maybe it's a little bit better, but like I have an open front yard, like a child or an animal, like walking up to that thing, just, I know it would presumably detect it and do whatever it needs to do to, like, I don't know if it shuts down or how they operate, but man.
Yeah, there is a liability there. I'm not going to lie. I've talked with the Yarbo people. Yarbo are the folks that make the robot snowblower and lawnmower and other things, like the robot, the outdoor robot, if you will. And they say that there's, as soon as it detects a human in its path, it stops.
Right.
And it will not resume on its own. It requires you to intervene and turn it back on. So, like, and they said, that's a software issue and like, you know, business decision. So, like, absolutely, we've also had it in the lab and stuff, you know, set up to where once it's free and clear, it goes. And it has been 100% fine. However, they don't want the story told that you allude to potentially being told about their product. So they're like, nope, once it detects a human, could be that one, could be a different one, or a pet, or anything, any sort of, you know, thing that would be an issue. It's like, nope, you've got to now come out and touch a button on it to make it go.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yep. Yeah, I assume you get an alert. And
yes.
It's like, hey, I stopped.
Yep. And then, you know, the Yarbo, they've got a couple of models, and the less expensive one does not do like auto mapping. You have to drive it with your phone, but it has cameras in it and all that. So for like the snowblowing operation, you could drive it from your phone while sitting in front of the fireplace with hot cocoa, you know, and that's not so nice. Terrible, is it? Yeah. So... like that also would be an option that you could, you know, do that. Hopefully, even if you're driving it, if it senses a human, it stops. With it doesn't let you go after the neighbor or their dog. So yeah. Yep. All right. I know we're later than we usually are. Do you have time to do Anthony Adam, or should we?
Yeah,
call
we can.
This?
We can do. We can all do right. One last one. Okay. So Anthony says, hey guys, I just finished listening to their most recent episode where you talked about services to send tax docs and other sensitive info. A bit of a shameless promotion, but I can't help but recommend my team's product, new.space. New.space is the URL for another way to securely send sensitive documents. I know you two prefer Synology because it's self-hosted and feature-rich, but new.space has two big advantages over most of the other products you recommended: end-to-end encryption and no sign-up required. I think these features will make it a perfect solution to your listener Matt's issue. As you two said on the episode, file sharing is pretty much a solved problem, but we think we're building something new. It's not just end-to-end encrypted file sharing. We also have link sharing and notes with much more stuff on the way, including a native iOS app that is currently in test flight beta. So you can get the app from their website, new.space/app. Thanks for another great episode. Thanks for another great episode, guys.
Yeah. Amazing. That's pretty cool. I love this when we hear stuff that you folks are making and working on and all that good stuff. So yeah, thank you for that. Very cool. All right. Thanks for hanging out, everybody. It's been a blast as always. And thanks for sticking around a little bit later with us. I know we aim for the hour 15 minute mark. I realize we've been letting it stretch again to the hour 30. There's just so much good content, mostly from you, that we just don't want to miss out on sharing because it's cool stuff. Thanks to CashFly for providing all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. Make sure to follow us on, we've got our links on like Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and Mastodon and all those things in there. And, that's it. Make sure to check out our sponsors, coda.io/MGG and also barebones.com. And if there's anything, that you remember from a previous episode or want to make sure you didn't miss, go to macgeekup.com/sponsors. And that we have everything listed, so you won't miss out on deals. Adam, you got 3 words to share before we go on with the rest of our days and let them go on with the rest of their days? Oh, I think Adam's muted. I believe there's a mute thing happening. Did you get caught, Adam?
I did the thing I'm going to tell you not to do. Don't get caught.
Made on a Mac.
Thanks, folks. Later.